So, let's see. Any particular aspect of this chapter that you were struggling, or you want me to comment? I mean, it's a general comment about what is the meaning of phenomenology on Husserl, very general one, which is grounded in what we discussed before, and how to approach the sense of reality, what is the meaning of knowledge for these people who was in one way giving them a relevant dimension to the consciousness. That is the turn, if you want, of phenomenology. Remember, as I mentioned to you, Hegel was the first broad philosopher who extensively discussed the idea of phenomenology. But Hegel was doing this in a sort of system, who basically was a description of the world, if you want, in one way or the other. It was grounded in a theory of knowledge, but Hegel never went into the mind of the human being, as what we can say in that way. So he always was trying to make things in a collective way, analyzing history, analyzing culture, trying to see how evolution works and so on. So it wasn't a, let's say, so to speak, external view about philosophy and the world. But what Husserl did, and that's why we can call it the inside turn of phenomenology, is that Husserl transformed this phenomenological approach inside the human being. So he tried to understand how the mind was working, and this is typical from the 20th century. Philosophy in the 20th century turned into the inside of the people. You see, philosophers for, I don't know, what, 400 years were concerned about all the externalities, behavior of the people, experience, empirical data, how societies evolve, how history changed. You see, all these elements were concerning the philosopher, who were exterior, if you want. The 20th century is the moment in which philosophy go inside the people, meaning how your mind work, and so on. But you can say to me, but Claudio, I mean, even the Greeks were working in metaphysics. Yes, that's true, but they never tried to formalize that. What is new in the 20th century is that philosophers try to formalize the mind of the human being. And phenomenology, meaning Husserl specifically, is probably the first one. There were some attempts during the 19th century from some philosophers we can consider as a existentialist avant la lettre, but they were really not systematical. I mean, Kierkegaard, an example, or Nietzsche, if you want him all your day. Sartre is going to, well, someone writing 1A, so Kierkegaard. Sartre is going to consider him as one of the real masters, school of existentialism, and then Nietzsche. But they were not systematic. Anyway. Okay, so you see, in the chapter as well, this discussed the connection between Husserl and Heidegger in one way or the other. Heidegger is someone who went deep on this exploration of the mind of the people, and Heidegger is famous for a book which is called Sein und Zeit, which is English is being and time. He discussed this idea of Dasein, which is means be in the world. So for Heidegger, I'm saying quickly, understand, try to see how the knowledge is constructed, is try to understand how people is in the world. Be in the world is a translation of this, if you want, is the key element to understand how knowledge works. We need to understand the metaphysical condition of the people, not in relation with God or any particular supernatural entity, but in relation with the world as it is, biologically, naturally speaking. That is. Sorry? Yes, exactly. I mean, probably Heidegger is the one of the philosophers who make a synthesis of the philosophy as such in the 20th century. So if you say how many theories or schools we should have in mind when we discuss the 20th century, well, Heidegger in this is one of them. Because Heidegger was picking up a little bit from phenomenology and a little bit from existentialism. And if you see, a lot of people claim that Heidegger is one of the master schools for several theories in one way or the other. Why this happened? Well, as well for another reason, because those were the last philosophers to have a system, you see. Husserl, Heidegger, even Sartre, they were concerned to produce a system who was an holistic system, you see. A system who is going to explain everything. The condition of the human being, the idea of the world, how nature works, you see. They were trying to construct a comprehensive system. Those were the latest philosophers in doing that. Remember I mentioned to you before, one of the characteristics of the postmodernism, or if you want, structuralism or post-structuralism theory, is that we are not able to produce anymore such a system. We deal with the specific issues. We cannot, because the complexity of the issues that we're talking about, the complexity of elements that we need to consider, we cannot produce a holistic system, a system who can explain almost everything. That would be almost impossible. Page 56, an example. Comment of Eglinton at the top of the page. What is Valerie in that philosophy, among other things, is his insistence that theoretical knowledge always emerges from a context of practical social interest. This is something that Heidegger is going to explore. Third paragraph, again, I resume what I say. Heidegger described his philosophical enterprise as a hermeneutic of being. And the word hermeneutic means the science of art of interpretation. Heidegger's form of philosophy is generally referred to as hermeneutical phenomenology, to distinguish it from the transcendental phenomenology of Husserl and his followers. This means that Heidegger was much practical than Husserl. To some point, Husserl was following Kant. Remember what I think I mentioned to you, Kant. Kant made a kind of interpretation of Plato idea. Remember, this is the cavern. Okay? So, we have a fire here. We have an object here. And the shadow is projected on the wall. So we are here, okay, that's Plato theory. So what we can see here is the shadow. We cannot see the fire and we cannot see the real object, so to speak. Always, human experience is like this. We see the copy. we see the version B. We never see the real thing. Okay? So this is what we can call the model. We see this. This is a copy of a table with capital. We never have a direct experience of that table. And this is called in Kantians noumeno. The noumeno is that thing from which we never are going to be directly in contact. We never we are going to have experience of that directly. We are going to be closer and closer and closer, but never directly with that. Husserl picking up this idea and says that all our idea of objects work in this way. We have experience of different objects, but we never can experience the idea, you see, with capital of that object. We talk about the table. There is an idea of table, but we never can have experience of that idea in pure term. We always experiment this table, that table, the other one. So what is important is that our idea of this table is coming from the other idea, the general idea, the abstract one, the one that we cannot access directly, you see? This idea is idealist idea of knowledge is something that Heidegger criticized and says that is Platonism, you see, that is very abstract. And he changed it and said, no, that's not true. If we have our experience of the table should be here, should be physical, and we should have experience of that. It's this table, it's the table in the world, you see. That is the idea of transcendental, because this is the idea of the fact that we talk about an idea with capital means that we talk about something which is transcendental, means which is far away from us. It's idea. You see, it's a very general description. So in the same page, his most celebrated successor, I mean, successor of Heidegger, is the modern German philosopher Hans-Georg Gadamer. With Gadamer, central study through a method, we are in the arena of problems which have never ceased to plague modern literary theory. What is the meaning of literary text? How relevant to this meaning is the author's intention? You see, what Gadamer did is go deeply into the notion of interpretation, meaning go deeply into the notion of hermeneutics. Can we hope to understand works which are culturally and historically alien to us? Is objective understanding possible, or is all understanding relative to our own historical situation? Means, can we have a universal knowledge? Is that possible? And it's true, this is true not only for theory, literary theory, it's true for everyone. I mean, in linguistics, in art, this question, were the question of the 20th century, what kind of knowledge we can have about a particular discipline. This discussion, this problem that I have constantly with the undergraduate students, the interpretation which is dominant in your A levels in this country, the idea of intentio operis. Intentio operis in Latin means the intention of the work, means that you assume that you can know what was the intention of the author when the author was writing a book, which is silly. But this is still dominating idea in the curriculum, in the sense in which people say what the author was trying to say. I mean, language teacher always asks, what is the meaning of that? I mean, can you be in the head of the author? That's nonsense. But was an issue, still an issue. And there are people, colleagues, who agree with that idea, that they can go into the mind of the author, even if the author is dead or whatever, and try to guess what he was trying or she was trying to say, which is, to be honest, in my view, is a waste of time, because you never can be in a brain. But that has been very, very popular. Just in the middle of the page, the hermeneutical method seeks to fit each element of a text into a complete whole in a process commonly known as hermeneutical circle. individual features are intelligible in terms of the entire context, and the entire context became intelligible through the individual feature. You see, this is the sort of system that has been highly criticized for people who is outside this hermeneutic approach, because they say in a particular explanation, let's say, I don't know, linguistic, if you can explain an individual, is because you can explain where this individual is living, linguistically speaking, but the other way around as well is possible. If you can explain, generally speaking, the linguistic context of a particular society, you can explain the individual. This is the theoretical approach. You can apply this to art, philosophy, literature, whatever. It has been a really, really popular approach. But some people say that this is a vicious circle, and for that reason, it's not valid. And that's the reason they call it the Minervita circle in that way. So, but as I said, it was very, very, very popular. And then, following this, it says, 64 at the bottom says, indeed, one might very roughly periodize the history of modern literary theory in three stages. One, or A, if you want, a preoccupation with the author, Romanticism and 19th century. Two, an exclusive concern with the text. We can call that New Criticism. And three, market shift of attention to the reader over recent years. You see, this is more or less, if you want, a very overall. You can apply this as well to philosophy, if you want, to linguistic. This is a general perspective in one way. Is Eagleton view, I mean, I'm not entirely, however, it's a good description because it's a simplification that helps you see. So let's say, as we discussed it before, let's assume that the theoretical reflection, the theoretical approach to a particular discipline is something who in Europe start in the late 17th century, okay? If we accept that point, we are going to say that the first stage is something who covers, let's say, late 17th century, 18th century, and middle up to late 19th century. It's a period in which, as he say here, we concentrate in the idea of the author. If we try to understand something, we follow the author. We try to understand Leonardo da Vinci, we try to understand who Leonardo da Vinci was, what he was doing, how many work he did, and so on. The second approach, who came in at the beginning of the 20th century, call it a new criticism, is, okay, yeah, the author is important, but it's not that much. What we need to do is to pay attention to the text, specifically. And that will be good. So, one text, and then the other, and then the other. So, at the end, we are going to have a sort of constellation of texts, and we call that historiography. Okay? And the third, and the later approach, they say, yeah, the author is okay, the text as well is okay, but there is something more important nowadays because our economical situation, because the market that we have within the capitalism and so on, which is a reader. We need to identify the reception of the book. We need to know who is reading the book. If we can do that, then we can enlighten the text and the author. But without not knowing who the readers are, who the audience of a particular book is, we don't have a clue about nothing. Why? Because we are living in a society in which artistic objects, before anything, they are commercial objects. So we need to go one, we need to make a run, if you want. And then we need to understand, commercially speaking, how the object operates, and then aesthetically speaking. That's the reason why I'm sure you are familiar about this idea of postmodern idea of something that could be aesthetical but as well have a great value, economically speaking. You know, this trendy thing to, in the continent they call it design. You know, this company who designs something who is very, very expensive but as well very, very attractive, aesthetically speaking. You see, that is a kind of mix that the late 20th century present to people, in which you have aesthetical and commercial values all together, you see. So that is when people like Roland Barthes and the other came up and says the only methodology that we can have to analyze such a culture is semiology or semiotics. Because if we have a traditional approach, in the sense in which we said only literature could be aesthetically appropriate. If we have that approach, we are not going to understand nothing. Why? Because the people consume, aesthetically speaking, objects that not necessarily in the traditional conception are objects, artistic objects. An example, there are people who believe a car is an aesthetical object nowadays. And indeed, some of them are. A Ferrari, for example. Why not? So the discussion is, if we need to have a hierarchy in society, where we are going to place, let's say, the intellectual objects. An example, what is more valuable for you, the Ferrari or Nobel? That is the real discussion. No, if it's aesthetical one and the other is not. That is the old discussion. That is the 19th century discussion. No one bothers anymore about that. The discussion now is where we put our hierarchy, if you will. What is in the top of our hierarchy? Depends on the period, depends on the moment. How? So that is, to understand that, you need to pay attention to the audience. You need to pay attention to the reader. You need to pay attention to the reception of that particular object. It's the only way you can understand that. Well, this is the kick of your analysis. It's, to be honest, the chapter is not really complicated. I mean, then from page 70 on, he starts to discuss Yost, I mean, the reception theory. Very, very general things. I mean, really, I don't think that could pose any problem to you. The connection with existentialism, and that's it. Any questions? No? Right, okay, so imagine that you are in, I don't know, in some particular university in middle 60s, okay? You are an academic and you would like to do something, I don't know, different, something new. What you have at the moment is what we just described. You have an evolution of different school of thought in which you have some school who have been paying attention to the, let's say, to the author, some other who has been paying attention to, if you want, the idea of text, if you want, and then they developed all the idea of new criticism, who is connected with the idea of close reading, and so on. And then you have this idea of reception of the audience. But you would like to do something else. You would like to do something different. So this question, this situation, is the situation that people like Jacques Derrida and other people were facing in the middle 60s. They were trying to think in a different way. They were trying to think how other way we can think about knowledge and about literature, if you want. And this is when this idea of structuralism came up. The structuralism basically is a sort of extreme version of the hermeneutic circle, but ignoring the single element. You remember the hermeneutic circle, as I explained to you, says you can explain the single element, you can explain the whole parts. Well, the structuralism is, they say, you cannot explain individual elements. You need to explain the structure. You need to construct the structure of society. If you construct the structure of society, then you will be able to construct a logic to explain the meaning of things. And one of the few, well, one of the first author was Henri Lévi-Strauss. He made a book who is a mix between linguistic and anthropology, which is called Triste Tropique. He spent, I think, was near to 2 years in Brazil, in the Amazon, trying to explain a particular culture, and he came up with this idea. The idea that you need to construct a grid, you need to construct a structure. And we, you put in place this abstract structure, then you can explain all the single elements if you want. You can explain the mind of the people, the behavior of the people, and in some cases you can predict the evolution of that particular culture. He wrote other books later, but he is considered one of the first who was doing that. Other people came later, and probably the works from Roland Barthes, from Derrida, in the middle 60s, are the classic structuralist approach, and the most famous school probably is the one who was a journal, call it Tekel, was a journal who was published for, well, I think they still publish, I'm not sure. But during the 60s and the 70s, that was the top of the structuralism. So if you would like to have a taste of this work, you just need to have a look at an anthology. There are, in English, several anthologies who has been translated from this group. There is one particular special issue of a journal called Communication, who was early 70s, I don't remember, 71, 72, which is Analyse Extitulaire du Recit. That means in English, structural analysis of the, how we translate receipt? Receipt? How we translate receipt? Sorry, say again?
Narrative.
Could be, yeah. Prose, narrative, yeah. It's not the same, but it's more close, I can imagine. As it translated into English, so we'll be interested to see how we translate it. I never consulted, so I don't have an idea. But there you have a collection. It's an anthology of different articles, who really wasn't originally, before to be a book, was a specialization, which you have all these clear structuralist approach. There is an article from Roland Barthes, there is something from Derrida, it's a classical. So one thing that normally students do in the continent is they picking up this book, read the book, picking up two or three concepts, and apply those concepts to the book. What I'm saying to you is, if you're fancy to do something in structuralism, the best way will be picking up this, which is some of the articles are here anyway, two or three I think, and apply that to a particular literary text. That's it. That will be the easy way. That was a very, very general idea about structuralism. There is another discipline who came more or less in the same time, slightly different. Because structuralism was grounded, number one, was really have a close connection with the French culture and with the French culture evolution. That's point number one. Point number two is that structuralism at the beginning was connected pretty much with what happened in philosophy after the existentialism. So it was not originally a literary theory. Became more famous as a literary theory, but originally Lévi-Strauss is a philosopher, and all the people who were working in this structuralism originally were philosophers, as a Derrida. But as I say, later on, with the development of the theory, they became more and more literary orientated. At the same time, other people were working in another idea, because remember, those theories were trying to acknowledge the change of our society. Okay. The structuralism was supposed to be an answer to the complexity of our society, to the fact that we have media who dominate our idea of culture, to the fact that we have a capitalism who is already the logic who, in one way, we use to share the art and everything we are doing in life, and those all elements who according to these people, have been not addressed by the traditional theories. Why? Because the traditional theory were considered aesthetic as something isolated, you see, or philosophy as something isolated. What structuralism and the people who are going to come later try to acknowledge is the fact that we cannot isolate this discipline anymore. This discipline need to be in place, need to be allocated in a particular context. That's inevitable. So the structuralism produced their theory, and parallel to them, another theory, semiotics, came up. And this theory is much more elaborated, because the structuralism was trying to be in a school of thinking, period, nothing else. What semiotic was trying to do is to become a discipline, and more important, to become the discipline of discipline. There is a guy, which I think I mentioned to you before, Saussure. He was discussing the idea of semiology. Okay? Semiology should be the science of signs, but more important, should be the science of science. Why? Because they say, in our culture nowadays, what is important for us is not what is material anymore. What is important for us is the sign, or some people say the symbol, which is not exactly the same, but just to give you a quick overview to you. So, if we try to understand a culture, if we want to understand a language, if we want to understand a particular evolution of a particular society, we need to study how the signs, how the symbols work in that particular society. And to study that, we create a discipline, and discipline is called semiology, which is coming from the Greek, semiotike. Semiotike is that. Semiotike was a discipline that doctors, medicine, were studying. You see, you were sick, so they went to see you, and they were trying to see through your body what was wrong. They touch you, they have you, I mean, they make a diagnosis, you see. So semiotike is that, it's trying to make a diagnosis of the sign. You are bad, you feel terribly bad. So what happened to your face? What happened to your skin? You are white. That's a sign that you are not doing very well. Well, that's semiotics. Society works in the same way. You have a sign. You say, you have, you know, tough guy, blonde, big, bodybuilding, you know, in a, I don't know, Ferrari. Well, he's saying, you know, I'm the guy, you know, I'm bodybuilding, I have a Ferrari. So he's sending a message to you. No, because you can understand how he is inside, or how he soul, or whatever he is. No, he's sending you a sign through objects. So you associate him with the meaning of Ferrari for you. You associate him with someone who work out the body, and you will be associating that with whatever meaning have that for you. You see, that kind of relation, that kind of association is the way in which society and our life works nowadays. That's what semioticians say. And there are different approaches. There is one called semiology and the other one called semiotics, which is doesn't matter. It's not the same, but for us it's not that relevant. This will be connecting more with Bach, and this will be connecting more with Umberto Eco. But basically, they agree on the basis. And the basis is this. We are living in a society with such a complexity that only a discipline who pay attention to this culture of science will be able to produce a decent picture of the society, and will in some ways make us possible to produce an analysis, because this is the problem. If we are living in a society in which matter is not relevant anymore, where we are going to allocate our analysis? If we cannot analyze the matter to understand the table, fucking hell, what are we going to do? How are we going to understand the table? We need to understand the sign of the table, semiotician says. And then in that case, well, you have a Louis Philippe, you have a fake table who says, well, it's not a Louis Philippe, it's something that we made in the 20th century, but seems like a Louis Philippe. So all this idea that is present in our world about the fake, about the artificiality, about the, because we don't have the money to buy something which is original, we buy a copy. You see, how you can explain people who are living like that, and everyone is living like that. Or, more important, how you can explain a society in which people don't talk physically speaking anymore. The majority of the people in our society talk through technology. We are cybernetics, people in one way or the other. Why? Because we interact more with machines than with human beings. That is a fact. It's good, it's bad, I don't know. But the point is, how we are going to analyze, how we are going to consider the place of aesthetical object in a society in which people interact more with machines than with human beings. Certainly, we cannot do that with the traditional tools, with traditional theories, if you want. We need something new. That was what the people were saying in the 70s, especially those one who were connected with semiotics. Question? Yeah. Well, we stop here. So I will be tomorrow going through the chapter, making some comments, and we'll see where I arrive. But we should finish this book no further than 2 weeks after Easter. That's my idea. All right. So we need to speed up. Then I will be doing Paul de Man, and then I will be jumping a little bit on this one. So I guess 2 weeks after Easter for this, 2 weeks for this, and 1 week for this. Something like that. That one. There are several copies on the line, so you don't need to. Okay.